This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's been 24 hours since a federal judge ruled that Harvard University's admission process is constitutional. This was in a high-profile case centered on whether the school's admission process discriminates against Asian American applicants. Reactions are still coming in as colleges, students, and future applicants figure out what all this means. We're going to spend some time talking about all of that with current and former Harvard students and higher education experts. But first, we want to start with WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young. She joins us on the line. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And as we begin, I should note that I worked at Harvard for several years and my husband has an appointed position there. So, Carrie, remind us of the context. Why was this case brought in the first place?
Well, this lawsuit was filed by a group known as Students for Fair Admissions. They brought the case on behalf of Asian American students who say Harvard intentionally discriminates against Asian Americans and that they're held to a much higher standard than applicants who are Latino, Black, or even white. What's important to note here is that there is no one person at the center of this case, like other affirmative or anti-affirmative action lawsuits like Fisher versus the University of Texas, for example, that was at the Supreme Court in 2016. This was brought by a group. Students for Fair Admissions is funded and run also by a man named Edward Bloom, who is a well-known opponent of affirmative action policies.
So, Carrie, Judge Allison Burroughs issued a 130-plus page ruling on this. What exactly did she decide?
Yeah, she essentially ruled entirely in favor of Harvard. Students for Fair Admissions made four main arguments in court: that Harvard intentionally discriminates against Asian American applicants, that they had a quota-like racial balancing system. They also argued that race counts too much in a decision, or that it's a deciding factor, and that Harvard didn't adequately explore alternatives that don't consider race. But Judge Burroughs very carefully addressed all of those things in her response, and really carefully noting why she believes Harvard's admissions process is constitutional. The legal term that she used here is something called strict scrutiny, and she said it met all of that.
She also said that the process was not perfect, but a fine system, and she suggested the university should have some implicit bias training for its admissions officers. How has Harvard responded? Have they committed to doing any of that?
Well, so far, I've only received written statements from Harvard. I've also been checking their website. And so far, they haven't specifically addressed this from what I've seen. Mostly, they've just praised the decision and called it a victory for diversity, and that it really reaffirms that the school does not discriminate, in their opinion.
As WBUR reported, Carrie, the leader of Student for Fair Admissions, as you've mentioned, Edward Bloom, has said that he wants the court to declare that colleges and universities may not engage in affirmative action to get more students from underrepresented groups on campus. So what was Bloom's reaction to this ruling, and how about other supporters of Students for Fair Admissions?
Well, Edward Bloom has said, in a statement at least, that he's disappointed that the court has upheld Harvard's, quote, discriminatory admissions policies. He added that he and his organization believe the evidence presented in trial made a compelling argument. Bloom has also indicated that Students for Fair Admissions does plan to appeal this decision. Now, whether or not the Court of Appeals actually hears that, we'll have to wait and see. Asian American groups that supported Bloom's effort have also responded. One of them, known as the Asian American Coalition for Education, they condemned the ruling yesterday, saying it, quote, sets a dangerous precedent that condones institutionalized discrimination against Asian American students.
So it's October, which means that it's college application season for high school seniors and their families. What should they know as they consider and apply to schools, and will this decision impact them in any way?
Well, really, as far as I can tell, this doesn't change very much. This decision essentially upheld the status quo. Harvard is not required to change or remediate anything. So whatever parents were planning on doing or students for that matter, as they were applying to colleges, I would recommend keeping that plan. Nothing is really changing from this ruling.
All right. That is WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
We also reached out to two students we'd spoken to before the trial for their reactions today. Amber Ashley James recently graduated from Harvard's law and business schools. She was there as an undergraduate as well. She's African American, was a legacy student, and she hopes this ruling will send a message.
I hope that this ruling is an indication to people across the political spectrum that race on campus need not be a divisive tool, but that race and diversity and inclusivity on campus are aspects of the college experience that benefit everybody. I also think it's interesting that this ruling just came out when just a few weeks ago, there was an article that found that at Harvard, over 40% of white applicants were children of legacy, children of faculty and staff, and who were athletes. Those white applicants would not be admitted to Harvard if they didn't have those special application privileges of legacy or being an athlete or a student of a faculty or staff member. So this idea that Black and Latinx students who have really bad test scores are just getting in because of affirmative action and taking up the spots of really hardworking and otherwise worthy Asian American and white students is really a myth.
We also heard from Harvard student Julie Chung. She's a former co-chair of the Pan-Asian Council and previous co-president of the Harvard Radcliffe Asian American Women's Association. And she was happy with this decision.
I was overjoyed. I actually was in a meeting with the Task Force on Asian and Pacific American Studies where we were discussing this, calling this a huge victory, but at the same time acknowledging that, you know, this case is likely going to be appealed to the Supreme Court, and there's probably still going to be more work to do in the future.
Julie, you wrote an article for the Harvard Crimson last year where you took issue both with the SFA and Harvard. While you support affirmative action policies, in that article you also did criticize Harvard for, quote, failing to address potential systematic prejudices against Asian Americans, end quote. The judge in this case did suggest that Harvard needs more implicit bias training for its admissions officers, called the admission process fine overall, but did make that suggestion. What are you hearing from other Harvard students about that recommendation, especially among Asian American communities on the campus?
Race-conscious admissions really does bring benefits to the Asian American community. As we saw, many of my friends testified in that case, and we saw in their admissions files how, because race is such an important part of their identity, or for certain underrepresented groups like Southeast Asians, et cetera, that this does bring benefits to our community. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that we're done here, that excuses them from, you know, continuing to progress forward and making sure that they're doing enough for students.
What would that progress look like, Julie? What else would you like to see Harvard doing?
You know, students of color have been fighting for ethnic studies. I think, you know, having the education that supports a diverse student body is really important. And along with that, you know, students of color have also been fighting for a physical space. So like a multicultural center or a space for students of color on campus. So once students of color get onto campus, what is Harvard University doing to support those students?
That's Julie Chung. She's a Harvard student. She's former co-chair of the Pan-Asian Council and previous co-president of the Harvard Radcliffe Asian American Women's Association. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll continue our coverage on what the outcome of the Harvard admissions trial will mean for higher education. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. For more on the outcome of the Harvard admissions case, let's turn to two experts in the field. Raul Fernandez is a lecturer and the Associate Dean for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at the Boston University Wheelock College of Education. Raul, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Yep. And Natasha Wariku is an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and the author of The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy at Elite Universities. Natasha, welcome back.
It's great to be back.
So this is a thorough ruling, 130 plus pages. To either of you, do you agree with the judge's findings?
Well, yeah, I thought that the findings were very spot on. I thought she was, like you said, very thorough. I think she kind of systematically goes through the evidence and looks at what did both economists find in the statistical analysis. And she then goes through the question of affirmative action and whether or not Harvard admissions complies with previous court rulings. So I think it was very thorough, and it made a lot of sense to me.
So Edward Bloom, the president of SFFA, said in part, quote, "We believe that the documents, emails, data analysis, and depositions SFFA presented at trial compellingly revealed Harvard's systematic discrimination against Asian American applicants," end quote. Was there anything in what SFFA presented that's sort of like dangling out there as a concern, Raul?
You know, I'd say this. First of all, you know, I was able to attend a few days of the trial and to actually see Judge Burroughs in action. I think there is no question, at least in my mind, that Students for Fair Admission received a fair trial. She was asking all the right questions, I thought, and also she was quick to say when she didn't understand something and wanted some clarity. Her attempt was to give a fair trial for everyone involved. You know, I think there are two different ways. There were two different experts there, and if when you read the ruling, you see that she found the expert that was testifying on behalf of Harvard just simply more compelling, and with the statistical evidence that was provided.
So let me stay with you for a second. Mm-hmm. Bloom has made it very clear that he intends to appeal as far up as he needs to. But in the short term, do you think there will be any impacts on admissions officers as a result of this ruling?
No, I don't imagine so. I heard one of one of the students that was asked about that before, and I would agree that I think things are going to remain as they are right now. I will say there was a moment at the trial where Bloom sort of said, so we don't know where this case will go next, and the judge and everyone else in the audience laughed because we know where this is going next. We know that the intent of this case, it was brought to end up in front of the Supreme Court
from the beginning
to see what they do exactly.
All right, Natasha, you're at Harvard. Do you anticipate any changes to the culture or mission of the university in light of this finding or other universities in the area?
Well, I do think that these kinds of trials, regardless of the outcome, can have a chilling effect on universities overall. I think there is, you know, some new research that suggests that kind of lower tier universities that perhaps don't have the kinds of resources to withstand a trial like Harvard does are pulling back a little bit from affirmative action. And this predates this trial. So I do think that just the fact that there exists these kinds of lawsuits can make universities pause and worry about, well, are we going to now get into a very expensive lawsuit, and can we do that? So I do think that it can have this kind of chilling effect, even though the judge ruled in favor of Harvard University.
Sounds like you're saying, though, that the pulling back really started before this trial. And this trial, this judge found in favor of Harvard. You still think there will be a chilling effect on other universities?
I don't think that this decision obviously is a positive decision for affirmative action, a very thorough decision in favor of affirmative action. But I think that, you know, there's still another trial at University of North Carolina. And I think Blum has made it pretty clear that he's going to make this fight and keep going with this fight as well. So I think that, you know, it remains to be seen what this is going to do. This sort of overall kind of legal landscape is going to do to universities.
So earlier today, we spoke with Ilya Shapiro, who is the director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. He disagrees with the decision because he thinks the facts clearly established that the admissions process did discriminate against Asian American applicants. Here he is.
At the end of the day, I think it's hard to avoid the conclusion that the court here simply wasn't prepared to end racial preferences, regardless of what the evidence showed, because the evidence is pretty damning in showing how Asian American applicants are disadvantaged vis-a-vis white applicants, let alone blacks and Hispanics.
So, Raul, you followed this, as you say, you were actually even at the trial for a few days. Is there any merit to the idea that the judge was too quick to discount evidence that Asian Americans suffered in the admissions process, like, you know, receiving lower subjective personal scores?
Right. You know, I will say there's something to that piece right there. Harvard actually, during the course of the trial, surprisingly, ended up updating some of their actual sort of training for admissions officers to account for this. The idea of officers sort of discounting shyness and that kind of stuff and disproportionately discounting that for Asian Americans. So I think that was an issue. What Judge Burroughs found is that has been remediated during the course of the trial, so there's no need to address it now.
So I want to make sure. Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of a problem.
Right.
It's just that the judge found that had already been addressed.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. And I would just go on to say, you know, the larger issue here, and this was exposed throughout the trial. Remember, this is the case where Harvard's secret sauce, the way that they actually do admissions, was exposed for all to see. And one of the things that we saw is this, the notion of those ALDCs, the recruited athletes, folks that were legacies, deans and directors list, and also the children of faculty and staff, that while they were only 5% of applicants, they accounted for 30% of admitted students. If you're looking for where the room is to be a little bit more liberal in applications, you want to look at that 30%, not the very small percent of Black and Hispanic students that are being admitted to Harvard every year.
So why wasn't that the focus of this challenge, do you think?
Well, I think it's pretty clear. You know, I think I think what Blum has very cleverly done in this trial is to try to conflate any question of discrimination against of Asian Americans with affirmative action. And these are two very different issues. And I think that's an important thing for people to understand.
So explain it a little more.
So he has been trying to dismantle affirmative action for many years. He was behind the Fisher versus Texas case, the previous affirmative action case with a white plaintiff that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And now and for this case, he decided to, corral a group of Asian Americans to try to attack affirmative action. And so this question of, is there discrimination towards Asian Americans? We could imagine a scenario in which, you know, there was found to be Asian American discrimination, and yet we still think that affirmative action, race-based considerations for underrepresentation makes a lot of sense, even though it's discriminatory to do it for overrepresentation. And I think the judge, you know, she did find that this person, you know, you kind of alluded to this personality rating, that there was something there. It plays a pretty small role, but it does play a role. And it seems that Asian American applicants do get dinged a little bit by this, but not enough to sort of suggest that you scrap the whole admissions together. And I would agree with Raul that I think another way in which all students of color really are being excluded and being dinged is these, you know, legacies, a boost for children of alumni, a boost for people whose parents are donating to the university, a boost for athletic recruits who are majority white, a boost for faculty children. All of these categories are categories in which white students are gaining a leg up over all students of color, and they are categories for which it's privilege, compounding privilege, right? In other words, these are already advantaged students who are getting even more advantages, and that's what I think we really should be focusing on.
All right, so despite that, I'm going to put the ALDC students aside for just a second, and the judge did say not perfect. Right.
Yes.
Well, this process is not perfect. For example, we need implicit bias training for admissions officers. Mm-hmm. So how should Harvard and other universities get out in front of this? What else do they need to do to make their admissions processes better and more fair?
Right. And I will say one of the things that came out in the trial when the director of admissions was on the stand is that Harvard had not done implicit bias training for many years with admissions officers, and considering the last decade of race relations, that was actually surprising, if not shocking, that Harvard had not been engaging in implicit bias training. So I think doubling down on that is certainly a start. I would say, you know, having seen everything and now having the process laid bare for all to see, it does appear, at least in terms of the way that race is considered as part of the application process at Harvard, that they are doing it in a very fair way. There is no question. I mean, according to their guidelines, you can only actually look at race in terms of the overall score. There's no question that we're all humans who see and understand race. And if you wanted to give a tip or a preference to someone based on race, that you could do that through any part of the admissions process. Or if for some reason there was some implicit bias that would lead you to ding someone throughout the admissions process, you could do that at any point. And so a greater understanding of those issues is important. But the way that Harvard is approaching providing access for students of color to one of the most prestigious institutions in the country and doing everything it can to make sure that it has as fair a process as possible and one that adds that creates true diversity in its student body, you know, I find it hard to fault them for that.
So, Natasha, very briefly, what would happen differently in the consideration of an applicant if implicit bias were either greatly reduced or eliminated?
Well, it's the data seems to suggest, at least in terms of this personality rating. Now, part of the personality rating is guidance counselor recommendations and teacher recommendations. And so, you know, we can't sort of mandate implicit bias rating across the country. But it suggests that perhaps the percentage of Asian Americans might go up a little bit, not very much. I will say that I don't think that there's any perfect way to admit students. And I don't think that we could come up with a consensus. I don't even think the 40 people on Harvard's admissions team could come up with a consensus on what's the perfect way to do this. There's no one best perfect way that's going to, you know, there's no such thing as the very best of the best in this country. It really depends on the criteria that we're thinking about. So I think it's important to keep that in mind as well.
All right. That is Natasha Wariku, an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and author of The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy at Elite Universities. Thanks, Natasha.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Raul Fernandez, a lecturer and the associate dean for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at the Boston University Wheelock College of Education. Thank you, Raul.
My pleasure.
All right, stay with us. Coming up, we have Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo. He joins us to talk about his new book. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is going to be fun because chances are you've heard of our next guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, author of 8 novels, and a friend of the show. Richard Russo's new book is called Chances Are, and he joins me now in Studio 3. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Always great to be here.
It is exciting to have you. Okay, new book, Chances Are. It tells the story of 3 lifelong friends, Teddy, Mickey, Lincoln, who met in the 1960s at a small liberal arts college. They're now in their 60s, and we get a strong sense of nostalgia from them as they head back to Martha's Vineyard for a reunion, basically. You're about the same age as our main characters. Do you carry the same nostalgia for your past that this book seems to communicate?
I think most people, probably around age 50, thereabouts is when it began to happen to me, find themselves looking forward still because we must. We have children. We have grandchildren. The future is going to be important to them. And yet, gosh, we find ourselves looking backwards a lot, too. My last 3 books actually have been about me trying to make sense of this life that I've lived, which in many respects seems improbable. I'm trying to explain it to myself in those other 2 books and now and in this one.
So you say your last 3 books have been about you. There are 3 characters, 3
right.
male characters
right.
who are the leads in this book. So where are you?
Oh, I'm all over the place, Tiziana. just try to find a page that I'm not front and center in. No, I mean, in this book, with these 3 characters, I'm kind of assuming the wisdom of what Walt Whitman said when he said, "I'm large, I contain multitudes." I think what I've done in this book is to take these 3 friends and kind of divided my own personality. Well, I was going to say right down the middle, but of course,
yeah,
it would
be
divided,
right.
divide them in 3. Lincoln kind of represents every time in my life when I have ever played it safe, and often because I've had to. What these 3 friends have in common, of course, is that they do not come from wealth, and they're all living their lives essentially without a safety net. If they mess up, it's on them. And Lincoln is the kind of guy who feels that pressure a lot, and it has caused him over the course of his lifetime to play it safe probably more than he should. And he's come to now that age. They're all 67 when this book begins. And he's come to now wonder what his life would have been like if he'd taken a few more chances. Teddy is, I think, represents more of the kind of spiritual aspect of my own existence. My readers, I don't think, are going to be terribly surprised to learn that I was an altar boy right straight through high school.
Not a shock.
And Teddy, even as he has fallen in love with the same beautiful girl that his 2 friends have, he has no trouble any more than I did at 14 or 15 imagining himself as both a ladies' man and perhaps a holy man.
Yeah, kind of celibate, but also Lothario.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Those are not contradictions to his mind, at least not at age 15. And he is seriously, at least as seriously as you can at that age, contemplating a kind of monastic life. Mickey, the third friend, is that part of my personality that when I have my doubts about how I've lived my life, when I think, okay, I've written these books and I love having done it, but have I really lived the right life? That's usually when there's a great song on the radio. And at that point, all I want to do is what Mickey does, is strap on a Fender Stratocaster guitar, plug it into a killer amp, and play rock and roll music at a very high volume.
It's funny, as I read him, I realized that I had nicknamed him in my head the human motorcycle.
Yeah.
I grew up with Harley people. And
did you?
Yeah. And
I wouldn't have guessed that.
There's something about Mickey. He's like a human motorcycle.
Yeah.
You know, he's out on the open road doing his thing.
Yeah. And without a helmet.
Yeah.
Too.
Which comes up, I think.
Yeah.
All right. So one of the themes we think that you're exploring in this book is this sense of free will versus destiny.
Right.
There is really an idea that can be a moment or a choice that either fixes you kind of in place or changes your path. Are we right? We were talking about this and getting ready for this interview. And B, did that happen to you at some moment? Is there a moment that you are where you are now because of that choice you made then?
Oh, wow. There are those choices that you make for yourself. You say, I could do A or B, and you choose A. And then you wonder what would have happened if you'd chosen B. And then there are sometimes other things that are involved. Choices get made for you, especially when you're young. The real crossroads in my life was when I was 17/18. And I was living in a small upstate New York mill town. My parents had split up, so I was living with my mother. And my mother had grown up in that same town. And she was now in her late 40s and felt completely trapped in her life there. We lived upstairs over my grandparents. And she was just desperate to go somewhere else. And she decided that she wanted to move to Arizona. The problem was she had no way to get there. She didn't drive herself, so she used me to drive the getaway car. In a sense, she allowed me to buy a car, which so surprised me. She started leaving little clues around the house about where I should go to college. Maybe the University of Arizona would be nice, she said. And I just followed those little crumbs around the house and ate them until when I was 18, only had my driver's license for just a few months. We hitched a U-Haul trailer to the back of our underpowered car, and we drove like a couple of fools. We drove all the way across the United States in a car that we had to choose. We actually had to choose where we would stay. We had to choose our motels according to how steep the exit ramp was.
And I want you to know, as I'm listening to you, there is road trip music playing in my head as I'm listening to you.
Yeah. So, I mean, we did that. We should have died. We should have died on the road. I didn't know how to do that. I wouldn't have known how to do it even if I wasn't towing a trailer. But I didn't know how to do that. And somehow we made it. And I learned when we got there that my mother didn't have the job at General Electric she said she had. She didn't know how to drive, but she had to learn, after which the car was hers. I went down to the University of Arizona. It's the single most foolish thing I can ever think of two reasonably smart people doing. And every single good thing in my life has come from that. I went to Arizona. I met my wife of 48 years there, who gave us our two wonderful daughters and now grandchildren. I became a man there. I became a writer there. All as a result of foolishness.
Also of your mother. I mean, also of this woman. And so that is very interesting. So JC is the female main character.
Yeah.
And I both loved her and felt like she was a device, not a person, in the story. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you about that. In part, was she a device more than a person in the story? And was she the alter ego of all the mothers who were so contained and restrained in the story as well?
That's true. All three of the mothers in this story have taken a back seat in some way to the men who they're married to, and they haven't had an awful lot of choice. And part of it was the time. But I think more than that, JC is kind of an unknown because this is a story that's not about what men know about women. It's a story about what they don't know. And one of the things that they don't know when all three of these young men fall in love with JC, they think they're falling in love with her because she's smart and she's beautiful and she's sexy and she's an embodiment of the times, of freedom. What they don't understand that she is also an embodiment of things that they have been chasing without even knowing that they're chasing it. It's not just freedom. It's also JC's whole world. She comes from a world of wealth and privilege and piano lessons and all the things that rich kids grow up with that poor kids don't. And when you fall and when you're Mickey or Teddy or Lincoln and you fall in love with a girl like JC, you don't realize that it's more than her that you're falling in love with. So in a way, JC can't be as fully developed as the other characters because as soon as she does, then the book is about her and not what she represents
right,
to lower class
idea
kids.
Of
yeah,
JC.
Yeah.
So there's so many things more I want to ask you. I'm just going to pick one here.
Yeah.
You've talked about the wealth gap a couple of times.
Yeah.
These young men all meet at these sort of the quintessential wealthy, small, liberal arts college in New England.
Right.
And it's a huge part of their nostalgia and their background and why they have a reunion. And I kept thinking as I was reading it, these are the ones that are going to go away. These are the colleges and universities that people say, we're not going to have these in 20 years. Some of them have already started to close. Was that in your mind at all? And how do we think about the loss of that kind of an institution as they begin to fade, as some have and some will?
I don't know. We may lose some of them. I look around and I look at a college like Williams College, for instance, just off the top of my head.
As if
they
know,
look
who knew
pretty,
Williams.
They look pretty well provisioned for the future. Amherst College looks like it's going to be okay.
But look at Hampshire College, right?
So I think that some of these elite institutions are so well endowed, and look at what they're doing on their campuses. They may lose some of them. I mean, we may lose some of those institutions, and it would be a shame if we did. But to be honest with you, I've taught now in a bunch of state universities. My last teaching gig was at Colby College, which is one of those elite liberal arts institutions. And I loved virtually all of my teaching assignments because I had wonderful students in all of them. If I were to go back now and teach again, I think I would teach at a community college.
Interesting. How come? Why?
Because the democracy depends upon it. You know,
right.
That was a fascinating discussion that I was listening to earlier about Harvard. And part of me was thinking, yeah, I mean, my God, these kids are smart, aren't they? Listening to those students. And then, but I was also thinking the last time I taught at a class at a community college and among students who don't have any of that wherewithal, and they were great.
Yeah. All right. That is Richard Rousseau, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His new book is called Chances Are. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
No, pleasure was all mine. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Please join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.